on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged.
Today is Friday, the 27th of February. I'm Jennifer Schrimmer.
And I'm Alex Sarah Davis. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website citr.ca.
Good evening. It's currently 5:15 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. We would like to note that today is also our fund drive show. CITR is currently trying to raise $40,000 that will go towards digitizing our archive and making it available to our lovely listeners. If at any point in the show you would like to support our independent, volunteer-produced show, please call 604-822-868 or donate online at citr.ca. Thank you for your support.
Once again, that's 604-822-8648.
Today's top stories and segments are: Emily Blake has an interview with Gregory Allen, a UBC undergraduate student and member of the Screw Cutter project team. Emily spoke with him about his project involving a surgical device which helps surgeons create custom screws to treat injuries when surgical screws are unavailable.
We also have your weekly science and tech update from Marco, as well as your AMS update from Moira Warburton.
And for our final piece, we have guests from our station coming into the studio to talk about our fundraising event and the importance of independent community radio. But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, RCMP seeking public assistance following assault. On Monday, the RCMP released a statement advising the community of an assault that occurred on Sunday, February 22nd, in the South Campus area here at UBC. At approximately 10:10 p.m., an 18-year-old woman was grabbed while walking alone in the area of Mundell Park. The woman managed to break free from the lone man, who proceeded to flee the area and was not located by police patrols or the police dog team that searched the park. According to the RCMP advisory, the male suspect is described as having olive-colored skin, 18 to 20 years old, with spiky black short hair. He is approximately 5'4 to 5'6 with a medium build. UBC has released the police advisory in full on their news website. The university is advising students to walk with friends after dark, make use of the AMS safe walk, and to trust their instincts and call 911 should they feel in any danger. In the RCMP statement, Corporal Brenda Winpenny had this to say: "We recognize that incidents of this nature can be alarming to those regularly walking alone at night. Although we believe this to be an isolated incident, as always, we recommend for the general public walking alone late in the evening or early in the morning to remain extra vigilant of their surroundings and take every precaution to enhance their personal safety. Police are continuing their investigation and are asking anyone who may have information about this incident of the identity of the suspect to call the campus RCMP detachment at 604-224-1322. If you would like to find out more, we here at News 101 encourage you to visit the official press release at www.ubc.ca/staysafe.
In local news, Elections BC releases financing report, highlights system flaws, say watchdogs. In response to the report released by Elections BC this past Monday, several watchdog organizations are calling for reform to the municipal elections process, and it's easy to see why. British Columbia has a limited financial reporting period, a mix of individual and party-backed candidates, and no limits on individual donations or party spending. These three factors combine to obscure the actual financing behind BC's municipal elections, and watchdogs like Integrity BC say Elections BC's report does nothing to address the corruption within the system. Firstly, the report presents only a small slice of the financing picture. Since donations can be made to a candidate at any time, but must only be reported during an election. Secondly, the inclusion of both individuals and political parties in the local levels elections creates disparities in reporting. Regulations are such that reports filed by Gregor Robertson, Lyndon Heppner, and Derek Corrigan show that they received no donations and spent nothing on their election campaigns. Instead, it was their parties that collected the donations and spent from central accounts. And though we know that, for example, Vision Vancouver spent $3.4 million during the last election, it is difficult to be more precise when it comes to the spending for each of the party's candidates. Individual candidates like Malcolm Brody do report their donations and expenditures, and Brody's report for last year's election show his campaign spent just over $451,000 to beat challenger Richard Lee. In other words, Richmond's mayor, Brody, had to report spending nearly $500,000, while Vancouver's mayor, Robertson, reported absolutely nothing. Integrity BC's executive director, Dermot Travis, says that this exorbitant figure from an individual mayoral candidate should show us that the sums of money raised and spent by local politicians and parties in BC are, quote, obscene. The obscene financing situation can only be exacerbated by BC's lack of limits on individual donations or party spending. Though Quebec and specifically Montreal share the split system of allowing both individual and party-backed municipal candidates, they limit individual donations to $750. And even if a party ran a full slate of candidates for the city's 103 council and borough positions, they would be limited to spending only $1.65 million. Compare that limit of $1.65 million with Vision Vancouver's reported expenditures of $3.4 million, more than double the money in a city with less than half the number of eligible voters. What's more is that a full slate in Vancouver is only 27 positions when compared to Montreal's 103. In what way does allowing twice the spending for one-third of the municipal positions make any sense? Watchdogs have been vocal about the overspending in municipal BC elections for a long time, and MLAs in the BC legislature have supposedly been working on reforms since before last year's election. Integrity BC's Dermot Travis says, quote, "I don't expect legislation to be tabled in this session at all. Maybe next fall, maybe the spring session after that." Adding that as long as municipal spending is this high and this difficult to get accurate numbers on, it will be difficult for the BC government to effectively limit it. The next large-scale vote here in BC will be the transit referendum over whether or not sales tax should see a 0.5% increase to fund TransLink expansion. Campaigners and third parties are not in any way required to report who donated what during that campaign.
Vancouver School Board to overhaul lunch programs. Spokesman Kurt Heinrich stated yesterday that the school board would be moving to discontinue its subsidized lunch programs for schools in gentrifying neighborhoods in favor of free lunches for vulnerable students across Vancouver. Under the previous system, 19 Vancouver elementary schools, many located in gentrifying neighborhoods and the inner city, received funding to provide their students with lunches, and parents were asked to pay only what they could, if they could, each month. The distribution of these funds are reviewed every 5 years, and last year's report showed that the 19 school system was not as effective as it had hoped. Heinrich said, "A school that was approved for subsidy 5 years ago and might have had a high percentage of vulnerable children in it, 5 years later, we're seeing that the school is no longer profiting." In other words, the vulnerable children don't always appear to attend the same schools, and basing the programs on individual schools has limited their efficiency. Also worth considering are the demographic shifts currently happening in Vancouver. Principal Darren Mitzel has said his school's catchment area is changing quite a bit because of Vancouver's west to east movement. Families are increasingly seeking homes outside of the unaffordable west side, and this phenomenon seems to be contributing to the school-based subsidies' inability to effectively help vulnerable students. School trustees Patty Bacaus told reporters that a series of indicators showed that poverty was moving into South Vancouver and other areas across the city, saying that you'll see lots of families scattered all over the city living in different situations that are struggling. What came to our attention in the review is that we're missing a lot of kids. The school board is taking some immediate action. Next school year, the number of schools receiving subsidies to provide free lunches will drop from 19 to 15, with only those schools that continue to have a high percentage of vulnerable students receiving funding. Patty Bacaus explained that the rest of the money will go to other schools across Vancouver, where those students deemed vulnerable will discreetly receive free bag lunches as a part of a new lunch-to-go program.
In national news, the Supreme Court has refused to hear citizen oath to Queen challenge. On Thursday, the Supreme Court of Canada declined to hear a constitutional challenge from three permanent residents in the Toronto area. These residents have refused to swear the citizenship oath because they oppose the monarchy and take offense at having to swear allegiance to the Queen. This means they cannot become Canadians or take part in elections. Immigrants seeking citizenship in Canada are required to swear to, quote, be faithful and bear true allegiance to Queen Elizabeth II, Queen of Canada, her heirs and successors. The three residents argue that this oath violates their constitutional rights to freedom of expression and religion. Specifically, the case declined on Thursday was to challenge an Ontario Court of Appeal ruling issued last August. The ruling, written by Justice Karen Wyler for the three-judge appeal panel, said the group was wrong to take the oath literally, citing previous court rulings that new citizens are not swearing allegiance to the Queen herself, but rather, quote, the reference to the Queen is symbolic of our form of government and the unwritten constitutional principle of democracy. Justice Wyler added that there was no violation of freedom of expression because they, quote, have the opportunity to publicly disavow what they consider to be the oath's message after they have taken it. As is customary when declining to hear a challenge case, the court did not offer reasons for its Thursday decision.
In international news, controversy surrounding HSBC money laundering continues. Serious allegations have been recently made against the Swiss division of British-based banking giant HSBC. The bank is accused of systematic involvement in tax evasion and money laundering upwards of 100 billion euros. In this addition to the United States court cases 2 years ago, when HSBC admitted to laundering billions of dollars for Colombian and Mexican drug cartels and violating a host of banking laws from the Bank Secrecy Act to the Trading with the Enemy Act. That case ended with the U.S. Justice Department electing not to pursue criminal prosecutions of the bank executives, but rather opting for a record financial statement of 1.9 billion U.S. dollars. At the time, analysts noted that this seemingly large settlement was, in fact, only about 5 weeks of income for the bank. The most recent allegations have been brought against HSBC as a result of major leaks coming out of Switzerland, some of which show that the bank's Geneva branch supported its clients in their illegal business dealings for years. HSBC acquired its Swiss subsidiary in 1999 for $10 billion, and Swiss banking experts like Jan Trepp agree that there would have been no reason for the bank to pursue such an acquisition or pay such a large sum of money unless it explicitly wanted this sort of criminal clientele. This clientele was mostly based in Switzerland, France, and England, with sizable portions were also based out of the United States, Brazil, Mexico, and Saudi Arabia, and at least a dozen clients from nearly every country in the world. HSBC clients were given the ability to open an account at the Swiss subsidiary, which allowed them to open and transfer money to a number of sub-accounts, and even shelter their money in a foundation based in an offshore tax haven. The leak also reveals that HSBC may have been actively helping criminal organizations launder money. The leak lists dealers of narcotics, blood diamonds, and weapons as clients, including even top-level financial backers of Al-Qaeda. As banking expert Gian Trepp puts it, quote, the bank is clearly guilty. It would be one thing if there were just a few cases, but there were 100,000. HSBC has responded to the leak by admitting that it had made errors in the past, but claiming that it has since ended its relationship with these problematic clients. The veracity of such claims remains to be seen.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
CITR's annual fundraiser kicks off this February 26th at UBC's Pitt Pub. Is CITR your favorite radio station? Do you feel an intense desire to support its continuing mission to provide alternative programming that you literally will not hear anywhere else? Maybe you answered yes, or maybe you just like to get wild and listen to good music. Either way, this event promises to provide all of that and more. Featuring Ace Martins, Atsy, Tits and Bread, Listening Party, and student DJs between bands. Admission is $5 or $3 for CITR members and club affiliates. All proceeds go towards CITR's 2015 fund drive, running from February 26th to March 6th. Of something to
happen. Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have Emily Blake's interview with Gregory Allen, a UBC graduate student and member of the Screwcutter project team. Emily spoke with him about his project involving a surgical device which helps surgeons create custom screws to treat injuries when surgical screws are unavailable.
So would you like to explain the project a little bit?
The Screwcutter project was born out of a program called Engineers and Scrubs, which is sort of like a tie-on to your thesis. So instead of taking specific courses for, let's say, an electrical engineer, you take courses specifically for engineers and scrubs. And one of those courses is called the design course. And you design a medical device. And that's how it started. We had a collaboration with USTOP, and clinicians came to us and pitched ideas in what's called a MedTech Cafe. So in our instance, orthopedic surgeons came, and they were really excited by the idea, of course. And they said, well, it's great. You know, we go to Uganda every year, and we have this horrible problem where patients don't have the proper inventory to do surgery correctly. And we were like, okay, that's interesting. Why don't you tell us a bit more about that? And they said, in particular, when we're doing, let's say, fracture repair of your femur, they don't have the proper screws to do it. So they're left with two choices. Either they can use a screw that's too big. So you can imagine inserting a screw that's too big for your bone. There, you're going to have a screw sticking out one side or the other. Or you can use a screw that's too short, which could possibly lead to the fracture not being compressed properly, leading to more complications, or they don't do the surgery at all. So those three alternatives don't really seem like very good alternatives. And they said, we really need a way to cut screws properly. They use bolt cutters, very similar to a bolt cutter you'd find at Home Depot. And they said it's not appropriate for what happens. They get burrs, they get improperly cut threads, and they said, let's think about this together and let's work on a solution that can cut screws properly for the clinical environment. And that's what the Screwcutter project was born out of.
So who all is involved in the project?
Of course, I am not the only one. The team initially started with myself, Shale Rizmani, and Vivian Chung, who are all in the Engineers and Scrubs program as well, and we all formed a team together. And very recently, we've taken on an amazing engineer and designer, Andrew Mayer, and he is on our team now too. So it's just the four of us.
Does it connect to UBC?
There's a lot of connections, actually. So the Screwcutter project itself is based out of the Center for Hip Health and Mobility. So we have very strong relations with them. They have given us space to work, and also we have a lot of connections being made through them with other orthopedic surgeons. In terms of connection to UBC, the Engineers and Scrubs course is a UBC course, and it was originally supervised by Dave Wilson, who was the acting program supervisor. Of course, the program was created by Tony Hodgson. We've sort of moved away from that direct supervision, and UBC doesn't directly have any relations with us, but we still use the budget that Engineers and Scrubs gave us, which has been used for prototyping.
What stage are you at in this project?
We're really happy to say that we've actually sent a prototype over to Uganda, where it was handled, taken apart. It wasn't used for surgery, though, which is an important distinction. It was brought back to us with a couple of ideas, design iterations, and so for almost the past 10 months, we've been working on the new version of the Screwcutter, which is significantly lighter, a third of the size. We're really happy with it. And this device is currently being made right now, actually, at the BC Cancer Agency. And we're hoping to have it done perhaps in a week or two.
So are these going to be able to be produced en masse, or how much are they going to cost people to buy?
Yeah, people love to ask us, how much are they going to cost? Which is a very valid question because, you know, we're going into a low-resource country and they can't even afford to, let's say, buy the orthopedic screws sometimes. We're in a bit of a bind. Right now, we're targeting for it to be built at $100. Obviously, right now, we're doing one-off designs, and so they cost much more. But Like I said, the new version of our building is significantly lighter, uses less material, and has been engineered such that we can build mass templates, and then we just build from those templates, which will significantly reduce the cost.
So I know you're focusing mainly on Uganda, but are there other places where you know this could be useful?
Yep. We have connections in Sierra Leone. We have connections in other parts of Africa. The idea of screws not being readily available for surgery is a very common problem, which is really unfortunate when you think about it. We're very fortunate living here. But that also brings up the other partner that we're with, a surgeon from Royal Columbian Hospital, you know, just up the road almost. They frequently cut screws for plastic surgery because they don't always have the screw sizes that they need. And so not only do we have leads into low resource, but we also have leads into hospitals in our own backyard who also don't have access to perhaps the more, let's say, minute detailed screws that they need.
How common is it to use screws in surgeries?
Very common. For the most part, like I mentioned earlier, the femoral fracture is one of the main things that we're focusing on, especially in low-resource countries. Car accidents are on the rise. Motorbikes are becoming super prevalent, and low-middle-income countries account for 90% of road traffic accident trauma. So you can imagine that these low-resource hospitals aren't even equipped with the resources to perform these surgeries, and they account for, like I said, 90% of the world's burden of road accidents.
Is there anything else that you think people should know about the project?
I think what I like telling people when we talk about the project is there are so many opportunities for engineers to put their skills to good use, especially when it comes to low-resource countries. People usually think that, let's say if a hospital is lacking a CT scanner, they think, oh, okay, we can solve that. We send them a CT scanner and that'll be the end of that. But no consideration is ever done to the fact that, well, hold on, if we send a CT scanner over, they don't have the proper voltage. It's inconsistent and it frequently shorts CT scanners. So that's a waste investment. And so the interesting thing when doing this project is we have to be very careful about considering how the device works in their environment, not our environment. And it's difficult for us because I've never been to Uganda. Our team is hopefully going to go in April, but we have a lot of resources in Uganda. We have a lot of surgeons that we have to rely on every day who tell us, you know what, it can't use power. It has to be simple. It has to be able to be used by anyone. And these are considerations that are very unique to the situation. And I like the challenge of almost cutting down my perspective of Western medicine and putting myself in their shoes.
Would you say that there's a moral or ethical component to the project as well?
Absolutely. I think the project has a great cause. That being said, we are not thinking at the moment that we're going to be incorporated as a not-for-profit. We're probably going to be a for-profit business just because of how likely the not-for-profit model will fail. So it's definitely a driver that we can produce these devices and know that people whose surgery is being delayed or they're getting less than reasonable standard of care, that we can try to help them.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you, Emily. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Hey there, listeners. You're tuned in to CITR's annual fundraiser, Fund Drive. Every year, Fund Drive raises money to keep CITR running. Last year, we raised over $39,000 to assist our move to a new station. This year, Fund Drive runs February 26th to March 6th with a finale party at Pat's Pub. So let's get digital. We're trying to raise $40,000 to build a new website, digitize our analog archives, and make decades worth of CITR history accessible and more. Call now at 604-822-8648. That's 604-UBC-UNIT to pledge towards this year's fund drive. Or donate online at www.citr.ca. Receive great prizes for your donations. Help keep campus and community radio healthy. Donate to support CITR.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thanks for being with us.
Up next, we have your weekly science and tech update from Marco.
Good afternoon. Our first two stories concern environmental topics. In the first one, it's about mega droughts. NASA scientists and scientists in Massachusetts are sounding alarms over carbon emissions that could drastically increase the risk of U.S. and not just U.S. worldwide mega droughts. In previous times, scientists would use measures of atmospheric CO2 and soil moisture data to predict future drought levels. But NASA scientists are now using tree rings to understand past droughts and climate models and incorporating these into their soil moisture data to estimate future drought risk in the 21st century. Droughts in the U.S., Southwest, and Central Plains during the last 50 years could be drier and longer than before, according to a new NASA study. The researchers used various climate models, plus the NASA data, to conclude that human-produced greenhouse gases emissions are driving up a severe risk of drought. Even if greenhouse gas emissions were to totally stop, within the next 50 years, the likelihood of a major drought has increased to 60%. But if greenhouse gas emissions continue at their current rate, the risk is 80%. Ben Cook, a climate scientist from NASA, said natural droughts like the 1930s Dust Bowl and the current Southwest dry drought could pale in significance to future drought. The new research points to data that shows that future droughts will last 30, 50, or 80 years, even longer. Scientists analyzed a drought severity index and two moisture data sets from the soil and atmospheric CO2 concentration to sound alarm. But NASA announced that history of the droughts during the past 1,000 years was also needed. So the NASA scientists are now counting tree rings and are looking, analyzing these tree rings to assess the future risk of drought. Their findings is that droughts could last much longer than medieval or previous century droughts, some which lasted to 30 to 50 years, but the new droughts could be much severer. To find out more about this, please go to www.nasa.gov/earthrightnow. In another environmental story, this one about e-waste, recent studies at the University of Buffalo have concluded that e-waste is going up dramatically. Things like mobile phones, laptop, and other electric gizmos are populating our dumping sites now. But part of the problem is also electronic gadget hoarding. People are reluctant to let go of their old electronic products for sentimental reasons. So scientists now are developing mathematical models to simulate consumer behavior and how design decisions can contribute to e-waste. They want to get the e-waste back into the recycling cycle quicker so they can be refurbished easier. In our last story, there's a battle of the words and a war of the words coming. Yes, Pluto might come back. This is mostly a civil dispute, but it will affect our definitions of planet. A Harvard-led debate undertaken in 2014 is looking at the question, is Pluto a planet? This could have an impact on the definition of planet, not only in our solar system, but in the universe. If we count Pluto in, we have to count in thousands of other solar system objects. Count Pluto out, it's just a dwarf planet. So now the question is how to classify non-stellar objects such as planet, asteroid, comet, dwarf planet, and moonlet also. These objects are called trans-Neptunian objects, and the debate is coming where that could see Pluto and the dwarf planet Eris included, so we will have 10 planets. Stay tuned. More on this later.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take another PSA break, but first, we'd like to remind all of you that this week is Fund Drive here at CITR, our annual fundraiser. This year, we're raising money to update our digital library and launch our new website. If you care at all about CITR News 101, or CITR, or independent radio, please consider donating to Fund Drive. So you can contact us at 604-822-8648.
Ocean, border, sub, urban, dispersal, determinacy, mulatto, mestizo, Métis, Cabra, Eurasian, Creole, colored, colored, split. Those who have no history are doomed.
An excerpt from The Reinventing Wheel, spoken by author, Vancouver poet, Wade Compton. Celebrate Black History Month with CITR 101.9 FM as we host content exploring Black history in Vancouver and beyond. Tune in this February and check out CITR.ca for regular updates on the scheduling of our Black History Month programming.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next on the program, we have the first half of our AMS correspondent Moira Warburton's update on the AMS proceedings.
Hi, I'm Moira Warburton, and I'm here for News 101 at CITR with your weekly AMS report. So, the AMS last night meeting was the first one after reading week. First on the agenda was the oversight presentation from the Oversight Committee. Veronica Knott was presenting. The execs get gifts, and they need to report them. So that was pretty cool. Apparently they get, like, Canucks tickets and things like that. They need to report them to the AMS. This was very important. They also have a $5,000 incentive. So this is based, they get this if before they got this based on 70% on goals, 20% on duties, 10% on meeting attendance. Oversight Committee has changed this to be more focused on meeting attendance and duties. Basically, it's a reward for going above and beyond the job. AMS execs, their salaries are apparently lower than at other universities. So the old system was punished for not going above and beyond. Now it's a reward. So then next to the presentation was the AMS services update. The speakeasy and SafeWalk are both very popular, so that's good. Paying tickets at parking services or fees at the library costs only 50% if paid in cash, and all of that goes to the food bank, so that's pretty cool. Then there is a presentation from the Build AMS committee. This committee is an internal governance review of the AMS that will be going on for the next year and a half, roughly, hopefully, if the budget gets approved. Basically, the general gist is that the AMS is a huge organization. They play a significantly large role in students' lives. Then the last internal governance review that was done 20 years ago, and 70% of the recommendations made by that committee were taken on board, such as creating positions like VP External Affairs. So stuff that we interact with a lot. And it hasn't happened for 20 years, so the AMS believes it needs to happen. It's important for us to have another one, because the last one was very old. It'll be a long process, but basically it'll be looking at where the AMS is now, so a benchmarking of sorts. Then it will be, this is part of the internal review. Then another internal review will happen after they've moved into the new building. And then an external review will happen after those two reviews have happened. Chris Roach's suggestion was that we should get the shareholders involved on some level because they can give us feedback about how they think we interact with them and what they think we could do to improve, which could be a good aspect to have on the AMS and its governance. So that was all good. The sub-update. The sub-update is potentially under budget, which was very exciting, but also maybe not. It was a bit confusing. Maybe more on that next week. More importantly, it was on time, so it will still be opening at the end of this semester. Ava was talking about how there are lots of themes being thrown around for decorating, including a Tron theme, which I thought was freaking fantastic. There will also be laser tag in the nest, and kittens, and massages. So basically it's going to be Google headquarters.
Thank you to Moira for that segment. Unfortunately, we don't have time today to finish the whole report, but we will hear from her next week when she will also be attending the AMS proceedings. For our final segment, we have guests from our station here in the studio to talk about our fundraising event and the importance of independent community radio.
It's not often that those who do the news become the news, but this week we here at News 101 are going to take the liberty to talk to you about something very dear to our hearts. This station, CITR, does an annual fundraiser, which we call Fund Drive. And our goal this year is to raise $40,000, which will go towards digitizing our archives and making them available online for the community to enjoy. And from a personal perspective, CITR is a special place for a lot of students and community members in Vancouver and the greater Vancouver area. This station is almost entirely run by volunteer efforts from students and community members alike. We work our hardest every day to bring you the best independent programming that we can. But we can't do this without your help. If you would like to donate to our show, please visit our donations page at citr.ca or phone our donations line at 604-822-8648. That's 604-822-8648. Every dollar counts, and we would love your support. Now, I would like to bring in a few people who work very hard at the station to make it run properly every day. And maybe if you could each kind of introduce yourselves and tell the listeners what you do here at CITR. I guess we'll start with John, our VP.
Well, shouldn't we start with you, Costa?
With me. Yeah. I am the news director here at CITR.
As the VP, I'm going to say that Costa should start first, yes.
Yeah, he's got the authority over me. So I run the news here at CITR with the help of my lovely volunteers. I put the show together with a crew of about 10, 20 of us on a regular basis.
I would say so.
And yeah, it's a great experience. Come in on Friday afternoons and get to do this with all you fine people. So I guess we'll go around the room. I'd like to start with perhaps John.
So I'm John. I'm student VP on our student executive here at CITR. I'm also the production coordinator, and I host Cue It Up 3 to 4 on Wednesdays. Tune in, and yeah, that's my sale. So,
Josh, how about you?
I'm Josh. I'm the Discord liaison, which means I work with the station and the connection it has with Discord on the student executive, and I am also the digital submissions coordinator at the station.
Very nice. Alex?
I am a news volunteer. I've been here for a year and a half, and it's my pleasure to be here for Fun Drive because this is always the best time of the year.
Beautiful. And Jennifer, you are our new arts intern. How are you liking your experience so far?
I am greatly enjoying CITR thus far. You guys should all send in some money and donate to our cause.
So on a personal level, I'd like to ask what CITR has meant to each of you. Maybe if you could talk about how you initially got involved in the station. Was it a friend that dragged you in here, or as it was for me? Well, we'll start with you, John.
How'd you get
your start here?
Excuse me. I was trying to derail the conversation for a bit because I have a bit of a cough in my mouth. Would someone else mind answering this question first, actually?
I'll go for it. I can't tell you exactly how I started. Definitely, I think it was probably writing for Discord at first. And I guess talking on a personal note, I think that it's the station's a really important point of contact for students, especially those living on campus, between the campus and kind of school life and university life and kind of the rest of the community, or I mean, what is, I would assume, the real Vancouver community, right, outside of that closed kind of campus campus community. So that's really important for me, and once I started to kind of uncover that, I got more and more involved with the station.
John, I saw you nodding along.
It's also great, you know, it's, you know, like you were saying, Josh, connect to other people's sicknesses and their colds as they're coughing in a closed room. But yeah, I mean, when you're doing school, you don't really have a means of necessarily articulating what you're learning, and places like CITR, it's a great place to actually enter and engage with other people and maybe figure out what you should be doing. Yeah.
Alex, how about you?
Well, I got involved at CITR in my third year, so when I was almost done my degree already. And my only regret is that I didn't get involved sooner. I actually was dragged in by the former news director, Morgan Yee. who took me on a tour. Yeah, that's right. Who took me on a tour of the station and really sold me on CITR's mandate. CITR is, of course, a campus and community radio station. If you've been listening for any amount of time, you probably know this stuff. But our mandate, according to the CRTC, is to provide a voice for those without a voice and to serve the needs of the local community. And, you know, as a student who doesn't often get treated with very much respect or given many opportunities, the chance to have a voice and the chance to be a voice for others is something that I really value, and I'm super glad that the CITR exists and that we have these opportunities.
I guess you've kind of already dove into my next question. I was going to ask, where does the role of independent media come in on a university campus or in the greater Vancouver area? And I guess Alex has already gone headfirst into this, but does anybody else want to comment on this?
I might want to say that it's a really important space for critical discussion to be happening. You don't really get elsewhere on campus, especially when it comes to discussing or taking a good hard look at the way the university is run and how things operate at the university.
John, I'd actually like to ask you a little bit about FunDrive. Where do you expect the money for FunDrive to go? What's the goal with this?
So this year, our FunDrive campaign is based around digitization. We just recently, in partnership with, I believe, the UBC Library, released online, free to look at for anyone to browse, to peruse, digitized versions of all past Discorder issues. And we're doing the same with our reel-to-reel content, our old cassette content, reel-to-reel content, just broadcast from decades and decades of CITR history, and that stuff is going to make its way online as well. But to help it make it there, you know, we can't just run on grant money alone. We are relying on the donations and, you know, generosity of our listeners to help make this project go to fruition. And that's one thing that we're really aiming to do with this digitization campaign. The second is we are in the process of creating a new website, which will link our two. In fact, Josh, you might be able to speak more to this particular aspect, but we are in the process of creating a new website and really just making it so that the ease of access with CITR is as high as possible. So there'll be a new podcast system integrated into this new website. There'll be a new ways to listen. You know, you can listen to secondary streams. There'll just be plenty of ways to actually enhance your ability to connect with the station.
And Josh, if I'm not mistaken, they're also going to be integrating Discorder.
Right. I guess it's going to make it easier to peruse all around. Just
peruse.
More,
you know,
perusing.
I don't think,
pleasure.
Does anyone know what that word actually means? Something
like meander.
Well, regardless of what it means, through. I think everybody should actually peruse that online collection of Discorder, because I saw that go up 2 days ago. That was incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, that must have taken an insane amount of effort.
30 years of Discorder that's going up. Yeah, but the new website, too, is going to be really cool in the way that it does link Discorder and CITR, and that's, I find that pretty exciting, maybe in a kind of a geeky way, but able to access content through podcasts and learn more about bands and kind of have like a full scope of, you know, maybe if you're interested in a band, you can see articles written in Discorder about that band, podcasts where they're interviewed, you know, they came on a show and they're interviewed, stuff like that. So I think that those connections are really important, and it's going to kind of move towards a more multimedia dimension.
Just being able to feature content. I mean, with the seamlessness of the new site, we really will be able to start featuring our best programs, you know, in a more promotional sense, in a more flagship sense.
Like cue it up.
No, like the news, I was going to say. Definitely. It's very exciting.
If this is something that you feel like contributing to, I mean, we would sincerely appreciate your support. And again, our FunDrive phone lines are open currently. You can phone us at 604-822-8648, or you can donate online at citr.ca. And I guess for the last couple seconds here, I just wanted to go over, does anybody have a favorite CITR moment that they'd like to recall? Alex is smiling at this one.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, what I love about FunDrive is that it's a week every year where every programmer just kind of bands together and tries to put on a really special show to raise money and help support the station. And, you know, if a programmer doesn't have time for whatever reason to make their show that week, we strongly encourage people to fill in. And some of the stuff that comes out of those fill-in shows are absolutely fantastic. I know John last year did a show with the then president, Ryan, and they pretended to be Matthew McConaughey both of them impersonating Matthew McConaughey for about an hour while playing music and pretending to be different characters that he had played in various roles.
So as it turns out, this panel was actually just a facade being used to promote my content, Jonathan.
It's true.
My show, 3 to 4 p.m. Wednesdays. If you would care to tune in, I'll also be having a fun drive special then.
I do have a question, John. We here at News 101 tend to ask the hard-hitting questions, and I have to ask you, will we be hearing anything from Matthew McConaughey on the show? No?
Comment.
I'm slightly disappointed. Anyways, thank you guys so much for being here. Again, the phone lines are open, 604-822-8648 to donate, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us, and I'll let my beautiful hosts take it out for me.
Yeah, that's our program for today, February 27th. Once again, CITR is currently trying to raise $40,000 that will go to digitizing our archive and making it available to our lovely listeners like you. If you would like to support our independent, volunteer-produced show here at News 101 or anything at the radio station, please call 604-822-8648 or donate online at citr.ca. Thank you for your support. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Alex Sarah Davis.
And I'm Jennifer Schwimmer. Today's broadcast was produced by Alberto Montilla. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM. To close off the show, we have Oh My by The Humans off their new album, Noontide. This is number 8 on CITR's charts this week.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Hey there, listeners. You're tuned in to CITR's annual fundraiser, Fund Drive. Every year, Fund Drive raises money to keep CITR running. Last year, we raised over $39,000 to assist our move to a new station. This year, Fund Drive runs February 26th to March 6th with a finale party at Pat's Pub. So let's get digital. We're trying to raise $40,000 to build a new website, digitize our analog archives, and make decades worth of CITR history accessible and more.
Call now at 604-822-8648. That's 604-UBC-UNIT to pledge towards this year's fund drive or donate online at www.citr.ca. Receive great prizes for your donations. Help keep campus and community radio healthy. Donate to support CITR.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now, let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Smash the dirty red scum!
Really?
Kill! That's really kill! Bad. Kill! Filthy bastard tummies! I hate him! I hate him!
Okay, well, You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.